Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science. The world can be a pretty mysterious place, and we at Live Science love to ask and answer questions about mysteries big and small, about ancient civilizations, our planet and solar system, the plants and animals that live alongside us, our bodies and how they work, and technologies that we use every day.
In today's episode of Life's Little Mysteries, we'll take a closer look at some of the mysteries surrounding one of our closest animal companions, dogs.
So for some people, dogs are like members of their family. Not me, I have to say. My mother had very severe allergies, and so when I was growing up, we couldn't have dogs in the house at all.
So you had cats?
We did. No, my mother was actually allergic to cats, too, so we didn't have anything. Uh-oh. But I know I had friends who had dogs. I know people who have dogs. And I know that, you know, for people who grew up with dogs, who, you know, acquired dogs later in life, they become very close to them, almost like members of the family.
Dogs provide companionship. And people who own dogs and who are on Team Dog, they treat dogs like little people almost, like little beings in their home, and they form pretty strong bonds with them.
Right. And dogs, you know, they're not only companions. They also provide protection as well as companionship for people with disabilities. Therapy dogs, for example, are trained to give comfort and support to people in hospitals and schools and nursing homes. They can help to calm people who have PTSD or emotional distress.
And they also do a lot of work. They're working dogs. They herd livestock. They sniff out drugs. They're used to sniff out explosives at airports and public buildings. They can even work as trackers and scouts for the military. They perform search and rescue after natural disasters. So there are a lot of activities, a lot of services dogs provide.
There's even one special service that dogs provide that I just love. There are science service dogs that assist in the lab with special custom outfits. I recently discovered this on Twitter. There's a dog called Samson the Lab Dog, and a researcher named Joey Ramp, who is pursuing a degree in molecular and cellular biology, was in an accident about 12 years ago, and she now works in the lab at University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, and she has a service dog named Samson, who was the first service dog allowed in the school's lab. And Samson assists wearing a special protective lab coat and booties and goggles.
I love the booties.
The booties are so nice. There are photos. And Samson is just such a great lab in a lab.
Yeah, and Samson looks, it sounds like Samson looks for any evidence that Joey is going into a PTSD episode or stress, like if she's rubbing her hands or any kind of withdrawal. And he nudges her to take preemptive action to help so that she doesn't have an anxiety attack.
Right. So this is just one of the ways that dogs combine this emotional support with performing an actual job, which is what domestic dogs were actually first bred for. And so dogs, they tug at our heartstrings with their friendliness, but they also inspire us with their devotion. Which brings us to our first mystery. How did dogs get to be dogs?
Where did dogs come from?
So, well, I think people know that there's a connection between dogs and wolves, right?
Right.
Right. So dogs diverged from wolves, Canis lupus, about at least 20,000 and perhaps as long as 40,000 years ago. So it was thought that they were mixed descendants of multiple wild canid species. So this includes wolves, jackals, and dingoes. But genetic data, along with studies of behavior and anatomy, point to the wolf as the sole ancestor of modern domestic dogs.
So where did this wolf originate, or this group of wolves originate?
It's uncertain. Researchers have suggested southern China, but they've also suggested Mongolia and Europe. So right now, that's something where the genetic data isn't there enough that they can pinpoint precisely where that divergence happened.
But we do know they descended from wolves that sort of clung or became acclimated to humans, to us. It was
survival of the friendliest, yeah. So what is thought to have happened tens of thousands of years ago was that there were some wolves that realized that if they allowed themselves to get close to people, then that could be a source of food. They would either scavenge what people left behind, or if they looked pathetic enough, people would throw them food, or if they looked like they were gentle and they weren't going to hurt them. So then what happened over time is that wolves that that followed this pattern of behavior then bred with other wolves that did, and then, you know, human domestication actually taking, you know, taking these wolves and training them. So over time, these wolves diverged enough that they became a genetic subset.
And how far back does that go? What is the oldest evidence of these semi-domesticated dogs?
Okay, so the over generations, what we have now, domestic dogs are a separate subspecies. So wolves are Canis lupus and dogs are Canis lupus familiaris. And the oldest evidence that we have is there are skeletal remains of domestic wolf dogs in Western Russia that are about 19,000 years old that have skulls resembling Siberian huskies. And in 2019, I wrote about the mummified remains of a puppy dating to about 18,000 years ago that were found in Siberia in 2018. But initial genetic testing couldn't confirm if it was a wolf or a dog or a wolf dog, some sort of transitional stage between between those two.
And then there was an old jawbone that was found, a 14,700-year-old jawbone, and that is the oldest undisputed fossil from a domesticated dog from this subspecies.
Right. So they were able to definitively say that this jawbone belonged to Canis lupus familiaris. But as far as the smoking gun of the relationship between dogs and people, the earliest example of that remains from 14,000 years ago of a puppy and an elderly person that were buried together in Israel. And I love this. The person's left hand was positioned so that it rested on the dog's flank. So this implies that there was some kind of a connection, some kind of a relationship. So scientists can infer from that that at this point in history, the relationship between dogs and people had gotten to a point where dogs were accepted in and a part of human communities.
I think that woman was from the Natufian culture, and that was the first Eastern Mediterranean culture to have permanent villages. And so maybe they had these permanent villages and they started to create these bonds with their pets.
Right. Well, if they had permanent villages, then they probably had a place where they were putting their trash. And
so
that's something that, you know, wild animals that were hanging around would figure out, okay, well, you know, this is some place where we know we can, you know, we can get food and then...
And a warm place to be protected and
right. And
pet.
Once they start, well, that's the thing. Once they start, you know, once they come closer and they start getting used to people, people start getting used to them, then that opens up an opportunity for them to develop a closer relationship.
And how did dogs change over time? Like how, you know, we went from this wolf to, gosh, gobs and gobs of various breeds of dogs.
Well, you look at the dog breeds around now and... They bear, and many of them bear very little resemblance to their wolf ancestors. So what happened over time was that dogs were selected by humans so that the tamest bred with the tamest, and then they were artificially selected for first for behavioral traits, but then for physical traits. So this is where the jobs for dogs came in, because people saw that, you know, once they domesticated dogs, oh, dogs, you know, are good for doing things. They can help us with hunting. They can help us with retrieving. They can help us with herding. So depending on what task was required of the dog, that influenced the traits that people would select, and they would then breed dogs together, whether it was for speed, whether it was for stamina, whether it was for strength, whether it was for a certain type of body shape. So all of these breeds, even though however different they look, they're still the same species, but they have different appearances through selective breeding.
And they weren't just breeding, so they were breeding for these various jobs that the dogs were doing, and that definitely changed how the dogs looked. But then there was selective breeding for appearance in and of itself.
Let's talk for a little bit about the jobs, because some of those jobs, I mean, even though they're jobs that don't exist today, these dog breeds that we see today that are so popular, they actually look that way because of their jobs, like dachshunds. Dachshunds were actually bred to flush out badgers and other animals that burrow. So that's why they have to have these short, stumpy little legs and these long bodies.
And long, skinny bodies. I did not know that.
Right. That's so that they could go down into these holes and chase out these animals that dig under the ground. Huskies, everyone knows, you know, huskies were bred for sled pulling and for withstanding the cold. Border collies were bred for herding sheep, and I've heard from friends who raise border collies that border collies are very high-energy dogs, and there are some dog breeds that are actually not ideal for certain kinds of living situations because they've been bred to do jobs that are so specific that if you put them in an environment where that's not, you know, an analog for the job that they're used to doing, then they're not going to do so well.
So those dogs look a certain way, act a certain way because they were bred to do certain jobs. Then there are dogs like the tiny Chihuahuas and the Yorkshire Terriers These dogs were bred for their looks, for their appearance, their size. Can they fit into a pocketbook?
Right, right. There are some dogs where clearly the only job they have is to look as beautiful as possible. So you have dogs that are, you know, that are very small, so you can like hold them in the palm of your hand, you can put them in your bag. They have long silky coats, you can put little bows in them, you can, you know, paint their nails. There are dogs that it seems like their chief purpose is to be ornamental and adorable.
Don't paint their nails.
Well, people do. People do that.
So are there any drawbacks to all of this selective breeding? We get what we want. We get the sled pulling dog, the tiny dog with bows in their hair. But are there side effects?
There are so many drawbacks. As the thing about selective breeding is that it's breeding for traits that we acknowledge are beneficial to us and that we can see. And the thing is, genetics is really complicated and messy. And the fact is that genes that give you one thing could also give you something else that's kind of negative. So that's one aspect of it. And then another is that by exaggerating certain kinds of physical traits because we like the way they look or because we think they serve a certain purpose, that actually may not be beneficial to the dog's health.
What are some examples of some of those issues that dogs have?
Well, if you look at some of the specific breeds, huskies are prone to autoimmune disorders. Golden retrievers are prone to obesity. German shepherds can suffer from hip dysplasia. Beagles are prone to epilepsy. Poodles tend to get glaucoma. And probably the best known example is the flat-faced dogs, which is something that's called brachycephalic. So these are dogs like boxers and pugs and bulldogs. And when those breeds were first introduced, the squished-in faces that they have were much less extreme than they are today. But over time, because that's the trait that people value in them, it's been exaggerated. So it's at the point now where these dogs can have very serious breathing problems. French bulldogs, their heads are so big and the females' pelvises are so small that the breed can only deliver puppies by C-section. So this is something that clearly can present some very serious health challenges for dogs.
And because of this, breeders are now under pressure to focus on animal health rather than breeding for certain features that might endanger dogs, might make it hard for them to breathe, hard for them to walk, hard for them to deliver babies.
Right. I mean, I think ultimately everyone wants a healthy dog. And so I think that luckily there's been more attention paid to this and breeders that are still producing dogs that fit a certain guidelines for specific breeds are taking into account dogs that have demonstrated, I guess, the most severe manifestations of physical problems and are not breeding those dogs to try and make sure that the future generations of dogs are going to be healthy. Dogs are our cherished friends, protectors, and coworkers. Though people and dogs are very different, they can share emotional connections that are unparalleled among the relationships humans have with other animals. In recent years, scientists have made tremendous strides in decoding the nuances of canine behavior and human neuroscience to better understand what makes the human-canine bond unique. Here to talk to us about that is Julie Hecht, a researcher and doctoral candidate who investigates dog behavior, cognition, and welfare. Julie, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what was it that first drew you to the study of canine behavior?
I think what I realized was through studying with Dr. Patricia McConnell at the University of Wisconsin-Madison as an undergrad, essentially I learned that there was this species, dogs, that we think we know so much about, but actually we knew much less than we thought, if that makes sense. So it was really interesting for me to find that we had all these assumptions and thoughts about dogs, but not necessarily confirmed or investigated. So that's really what drew me to the study of who they are on their terms, as well as their interactions with us and how that came to be.
Okay, who are they on their own terms? And what did you learn about that?
I think we're still learning a lot about who dogs are. And mostly that's because methods are constantly evolving. So you might have starting the study of, essentially the study of who dogs are and how they relate to humans very often began in terms of looking at infant relationship with mothers and infant relationships with parents. And so we took a lot of those paradigms and plugged dogs into them to learn more about who dogs are and how they related to us. But I think what we're finding as we go along and we're learning more about their cognitive abilities and interests is we're having to devise new paradigms that are more dog-centric. So that's one direction we're going. And also there's increasingly integration of multiple measures and different areas to learn more about dogs. So we're not just looking at behavior. We might use technological advances, neuroscience, physiology, as well as qualitative and owner report, and pulling together all these different measures to learn more about who dogs are and how they relate to us.
All right. So as you've explored these different methods and avenues, what would you say were the biggest surprises that you've learned about dog behavior and cognition thus far?
I think that, you know, sometimes we are spot on in our assessment of dogs. So sometimes you'll see news reports that say science confirms what dog owners knew or dog lovers knew all along. So sometimes, you know, science does support what we think, but sometimes there's indications that we were a little bit off. Sometimes our assessments were too anthropocentric or, you know, human framed. So my favorite or least favorite is our assessment of this guilty look in dogs, where we think that they have a knowledge state of a misdeed. And it seems that numerous studies find that dogs' quote-unquote guilty look is not an admission of guilt, but more instead a response to the owner behavior or some contextual cues in the environment. So there's examples where we are spot on, but at the same time, we need to test our assumptions and explore them to see if we actually are spot on.
I also love how in your Twitter bio, your nod to your research is just, it's so inviting. You just come right out and say, I would like to meet your dog. What is it about dogs that people find so captivating? And how does that play into the research that you and other scientists are doing?
Well, I think for one thing, when we, most of the research is conducted with companion dogs. So we don't need a laboratory filled with lab dogs. Essentially, the study of dogs and our subjects become the companion dogs in your home. So that speaks to the fact that there's something going on, that these species are so readily either living in our home or living in our environment, because there actually are many more street dogs and feral and free-ranging dogs than dogs living in homes. But regardless, anywhere there are people, there are dogs. So then we can say, well, what is it about either our human environment that either brings them into, you know, our setting, or what is it about them that brings them into our home? So we learn things about the fact that recent studies have found that when dogs and humans look at each other, we both get surges of oxytocin, both the dog and the human, and that this mutual gaze between known people and dogs, dyads who know each other, it's mutually reinforcing in the same way that infants and mothers experience. So that's just one area where this mutual exchange is not only beneficial for one party, but that they're kind of reinforcing each other. Then there's the fact that, you know, they're very attentive to our communicative cues. So we very often feel like they're attending to us, which they are. And then they're also attending to our gestures that we make in a human-like way. So it's really interesting that, you know, we feel like we're having a conversation with them. And in many cases, we can be having a conversation. Very often it's based on our behavior, our tone of voice, you know, cues like that. They can attend to specifics of our words. But we also find that through this wonderful dog chaser, the Border Collie, who recently passed away, you know, when she learned all these different words and different objects, the names of them, and able to discriminate different objects, it was through play that she was able to learn this great number of words. So it's not that the average dog is necessarily doing that, but it is that dogs are able to do that. So I think all of those features put together created this incredibly interesting species that we can't help but keep in our homes and have incredibly meaningful relationships with.
You mentioned responsiveness to gestures and also free-ranging dogs. And in fact, there's a new study that actually looks at the responsiveness to gestures in strays, where dogs that don't habitually live around people still respond to human gestures like dogs that are pets. So would that suggest that the special relationship goes beyond learned behavior?
Yes, I think that's a great point. And also we know that it's we like to try and tease out the nature and nurture components of things, and it's always going to be a little bit of both. You know, you can't say that neither had any effect, that they're both at play at all times. So the research looking at the free-ranging dogs that were also attentive to our cues is really interesting, because it's also suggesting that, you know, nature and nurture are both at play, but you don't need to be around humans 24/7 living in our homes to be attentive to our gestures.
Of course, some aspects of the relationship that humans have with dogs extend to other domesticated animals. But there's still something about what dogs and people have that's special and goes back tens of thousands of years. So what are some of the new insights that research into dog behavior has brought to that relationship?
One thing that I do like is that we're learning more about their behavioral expressions. So using different forms of behavioral study. One, for example, is dog facts, which is essentially this really intimate facial action coding where they're able to look at the expressions of dogs. We're able to learn more about the expressions that they make when they're either anticipating a reward or they're in some state of frustration. So we're able to really look at the nuances of their facial expression. I think that's a really interesting area because it's really about what they're giving off and trying to understand the complexities of that. I think one of the challenges then is you have so many different breeds of dogs that have all these different, you know, their composition is very different. So you have the brachycephalic breeds with a very short flat nose, you have the longer nose breeds. So we're trying to read all these expressions and understand them across different morphologies can be challenging.
And where do humans and dogs go from here? What would you say the future holds for the human-canine relationship?
Well, I think one area into the future, and that's been going on for a while, is this integration of all these different measures to understand the relationship. So pulling in technological advances, neuroscience, study of physiology and behavior, as well as owner reports. So pulling all those components together to get a better sense of the relationship. I also think that dogs do a lot with us and for us. So when it comes to the many different roles that working dogs have, I think that we're going to be increasing our ability to understand how to select and train dogs so that you're not only optimizing their performance and their well-being, but you're also decreasing the number of dogs who don't make it into a certain type of work. I think we'll be learning more about dogs' effect on human health and well-being because often we like to come out with these overarching statements that dogs are good for humans, but there's actually a lot of nuances within that. So I think pulling together all these different measures will have a better sense of how to best understand that and also bring it into the therapy or service realms as well. I'm personally really interested in increased exploration of the child-dog interaction and relationship because we know that there are certain periods, especially when children are young, where dogs are more relinquished during that time. I imagine it's hard to have like a 3 to 5 year old sometimes in a dog, but also understanding how to keep dogs in the home, but how to understand the relationship and the quality of the relationship that children and dogs have. And then another thing I'm hoping continues is we know a lot about the challenges of breeding in terms of inherited defects and challenges that dogs have through breeding. So I'm hoping that if breeding is going to continue, that there's more attention to these inherited defects and active working on the part of both breeders and the public to really focus on dog welfare and well-being and not necessarily what's the perceived as the cutest appearance.
I've been talking to animal behavior researcher Julie Hecht. You can find out more about her work on her website, dogspies.com. Julie, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Gina, this episode's really going to the dogs. I think we should take a break to talk about a special offer for a subscription to the magazine All About Space. From dark matter to explosive supernovas, All About Space features the latest developments in space science, here in our solar system and in the farthest perimeter of the universe.
Maybe you want to know more about the amazing technology behind the latest rocket launches and missions exploring the cosmos. Or maybe you're a stargazer searching for a complete guide to the night sky. Wherever your astronomical interests take you, All About Space has you covered.
In the latest issue, All About Space explores a mysterious cosmic phenomenon, phantom energy.
What is phantom energy?
I know, it sounds like something out of Star Wars, right? But phantom energy is actually a form of a type of force that, there's the Star Wars thing again, but it's pushing at the fabric of the universe.
And it's invisible.
And it's invisible, right. But it's called dark energy. So this is something, it can't be observed directly. So how do we know that dark energy exists? So after the Big Bang, 13.8 billion years ago, the universe expanded very rapidly. Right. And it continued to expand, still expanding today. So gravity should slow that expansion over time, right?
Wrong.
Yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't. Measurements of supernovas light in the 1990s showed that the universe's expansion is actually speeding up.
Why?
So it's speeding up because something is pushing it. And that's, this is the answer.
Something is dark energy.
And that something is dark energy, right. So that's how scientists determined that something called dark energy exists. And apparently it makes up about 68% of the universe's energy mass. But dark energy should decay and decrease in force over time as expansion continues. And it doesn't. Expansion is actually accelerating.
Enter phantom energy.
And this is where phantom energy comes in. That's right. So it's a form of dark energy that scientists figured out changes in density over time. And it becomes more dense and more powerful, spurring accelerated expansion.
So how does this end for the universe?
And not well. Eventually, it'll push the universe literally to the breaking point where the universe will experience what some are calling the big rip, when phantom energy's push overpowers gravity and basically just tears galaxies apart. But that won't happen for 22 billion years. So we've got a little time. So in any case, there's still much about dark energy and phantom energy that we have yet to understand. And you can read about it in All About Space.
In fact, 5,000 miniature eyes in the sky just blinked open to help astronomers detect this elusive dark energy, traces of this mysterious dark energy. And Live Science wrote an article about this. We described a network of miniature telescopes. They're called the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument, or DESI for short.
DESI's much easier to say.
It's much easier to say. And that was installed. Those telescopes were installed on the Mile Telescope in Arizona. Once astronomers installed those, they completed their first test run of the network. And since this invisible force that we're calling dark energy is causing our universe to expand at an ever-increasing rate, the best way to figure out that this stuff is there and what it is to have very, very precise measurements of that expansion rate. To do this, DESI looks at light from a particular set of galaxies. It splits that light into narrow bands of color, and it uses each of those bands to measure the galaxy's distance from our planet.
So what are the plans for DESI? What's it going to do?
In 5 years, DESI will have scanned 35 million galaxies and 2.4 million quasars that formed as far back as 11 billion years ago. So a couple billion years after the universe, after the Big Bang. Maybe, just maybe at that time, astronomers will identify what's causing our universe to expand so fast. You can venture further into the mysteries of the universe by subscribing to All About Space today. Just visit myfavoritemagazines.com and search for All About Space. We have a special discount code just for our Life's Little Mysteries listeners. You can get an additional 20% off by using the code SPACEPOD at checkout. Subscriptions start at just $5. That's myfavoritemagazines.com. Use the code SPACEPOD for an extra 20% off.
You can also visit Live Science to read more about how scientists are searching for signs of dark energy to better understand the forces that shaped our universe billions of years ago and may rip it to shreds billions of years in the future.
For our next mystery, let's talk about dog dreams. When your little furball or even giant Great Dane or Lab closes its eyes for a snooze, what is he or she dreaming about?
Well, first of all, how do we even know that dogs dream at all?
Okay, so we do know from going back to the 1970s, dogs, for one, sleep more than humans, and they tend toward catnaps.
That's very ironic.
It really is. But even though they have catnaps, their sleep cycles look surprisingly human, and they include the non-REM and the REM stages. So back in 1977, scientists actually looked at six pointer dogs to look at this electrical activity, and they studied them for 24 hours, and they found that dogs spend 44% of their time awake, and the rest of it is either sleeping or they're snoozing. So 21% was drowsy time, 12% they spent in this REM, REM sleep, and 23% was in that deepest stage called non-REM sleep. It's slow wave sleep.
Okay, so I know that there's probably plenty of, I mean, there's plenty of anecdotal evidence of dog dreaming on the internet. People love to post videos of a dog, like, you know,
twitching.
That's asleep, twitching, looking like it's running, looking like it's chasing something. But what's the actual science behind where and when these dreams happen?
So in humans, our most memorable and vivid dreams, the ones when we wake up, we can tell our, you know, spouse or partner about, are the dreams that happen in REM sleep. But we also dream in non-REM sleep. And this suggests because of dogs have these both of these stages of sleep, they probably also dream.
Okay. So is there any more evidence about what's actually going on when dogs are dreaming?
Well, yes. And that was found in rats. So a cognitive scientist at MIT named Matthew Wilson, he and his colleagues were first to find that dream patterns happen in rat brains. So to find this out, they recorded the activity of multiple brain cells, multiple neurons, while the rats, they were awake doing maze tasks. And then they recorded those same neurons when the rats were asleep during their REM sleep. And almost half of the rats during this REM phase of sleep, the patterns in their brains looked almost identical to the wakeful ones, as if the rats were reliving their fun, their playtime, running through the maze.
Okay, so let's say somebody wants to catch their dog dreaming. You know, like, yeah, how would you? Is there a way that you can tell from when they go to sleep when that kind of active dreaming might happen?
So this is what scientists think. They think that you should check about 20 minutes after your dog goes to sleep. That's when the REM sleep phase starts. And they might stay in that stage for just 2 or 3 minutes. So checking at about that time. And then at that point, you'll notice that your dog's breathing may become irregular. And then in puppies and really old dogs, you might notice the twitching or the running legs that you're seeing on YouTube or on the internet of people saying their dogs are dreaming.
And so what causes that twitching, though?
It's really interesting. So in dogs and humans, part of the brainstem called the pons is responsible for paralyzing our large muscles during sleep.
Right. So you don't, like, you know, throw yourself out of bed.
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, the pons is underdeveloped in puppies, and it may not work as efficiently in older dogs.
Ah.
And then you get this, you don't have this blockage, and so you get this twitching happening. Their large muscle groups are not being paralyzed.
Okay. So I know that sometimes when you see a sleeping dog and it looks, you know, it looks like it might be running or it looks like it might be playing fetch, but is there any way to know what dogs are really dreaming about?
So the only way we can actually peek into their dreaming minds is to deactivate the pons area so that they actually act out their dreams. And it turns out that dogs dream about doggy things.
Mm-hmm.
So pointers scientists have found will actually point at dream birds, and Dobermans will chase dream burglars.
So these things that they're trained to do in life, they will still be doing them in their dreams.
Yeah, exactly. And something sort of quirky that scientists have found, for whatever reason, the size of the dog may determine the size of the dream. So smaller dogs really may have more frequent but shorter dream periods, and larger dogs may have less frequent but longer dreams.
But do dogs have nightmares, though?
Perhaps sadly, dogs, like humans, probably do have nightmares. People's nightmares could be about dogs, and if you ever saw the dogs we're going to talk about in the next segment, you'd be scared and you might have a nightmare. Tibetan Mastiffs are monstrous dogs. They can weigh up to 150 pounds. And they can survive high in the mountains at altitudes where the air is so thin it would kill other dog breeds. And now we may know why. Here joining us to talk about his recent article on this canine feat is Life Science reporter Rafi Letster. Thanks so much for joining us, Rafi.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about this seemingly super dog. What makes it so special?
So if you saw a Tibetan Mastiff walking down the street, it would be pretty obvious to you that it's special. These are huge dogs. They're, you know, like 150 pounds. I mean, you know, this is nothing like most dogs you usually see. There's like lions with all this fur kind of erupting out of them. But the thing that makes them really distinct and really special beyond how they look and their size is that they can actually pull more oxygen out of a single breath of air than other kinds of dogs, which if you're living high in the mountains where air is thinner is really, really important. And so researchers were looking at this and why this might be. And what they found is that it seems like these Tibetan Mastiffs actually have a genetic adaptation, probably pulled from a crossbreeding with wolves, that gives them a real advantage in how they pull oxygen out of the air.
And how did they figure out that Tibetan Mastiffs have this gene or this genetic anomaly?
So it was known that this anomaly was present in their genes already, that there's these two genes that code for amino acids. If you know a little bit about genetics, what a gene actually is a molecule that helps give instructions on how to build other molecules that are useful inside the body. And there are two genes that code for two amino acids that are different in Tibetan Mastiffs and in wolves from the region than they are in other dogs and other wolves. And what the researchers did was they took those different amino acids and they looked at how they would actually manifest in the body and how they were changing, in this case, the way the dogs produce hemoglobin, which is a chemical in your blood that actually binds with oxygen and carries oxygen around your body. And they found that it's significantly more effective at binding with that oxygen.
So how exactly do these amino acids help the Tibetan Mastiffs live in such low oxygen conditions?
Under sort of normal oxygen conditions like we have right here in the studio where we're recording in New York City, it wouldn't give you much of an advantage at all. The dogs wouldn't be super breathers. There's only so much oxygen you can usefully pull out of the air. But when you're high up, you take a breath of air and there's only so much oxygen in it, and it's much more important to pull every last little bit molecule of oxygen out of that breath. And either one of these altered genes on their own wouldn't produce amino acids that would be particularly more useful at pulling that oxygen out of the air. It would be sort of a useless mutation. And also if you had it down, say, in New York City, it would be kind of a useless mutation. What seems to have happened was that these wolves that the Tibetan Mastiffs got the altered genes from had these altered genes sitting in a different part of their genome that isn't involved in hemoglobin for a really long time. And then at some point, it sort of jumped across the genome to the part of the genome that's really relevant for building hemoglobin. And once it was there, the Tibetan wolves were much more effective breathers. They could function much more effectively at high altitudes. They could breathe plenty of air, get all the air they need in situations where other wolves would have struggled. And then that, it seems like, was transferred pretty directly over to the dogs. So the dogs never had to go through this sort of long evolutionary process that they might have had to if the wolves hadn't been present. And once the gene was present in some of the dog population, it seems like it spread pretty quickly because it was super adaptive, super effective. If you're going to have a successful dog breed high up in the Tibetan Mountains, especially a great big dog that takes a lot of energy to get around, it better be super effective at, you know, getting all the oxygen it needs out of the air. And these really tight binding hemoglobin seem to have been really useful in that context.
Wow, that's so interesting. So the Tibetan Mastiffs were actually bred with these Tibetan wolves.
That's what seems like it happened. We don't have any video of that happening, but yeah.
That would be great. Thanks so much, Ralphie. You can check out Ralphie's article, Tibetan Mastiffs Bred with Mountain Wolves to Survive at Super High Altitudes, on Live Science. The link is in the show notes.
Tibetan Mastiffs may have been able to mate with wolves, but for some breeds of dogs, that would be a challenge. Can you imagine a wolf getting together with a corgi or a dachshund? I mean, that's kind of ridiculous. Yeah. But thanks to generations of selective breeding, many types of dogs have lost most of their physical resemblance to wolves. So that is just, you know, that's not going to happen. However, they did gain something else that humans find irresistible.
A smile.
A smile. That doggy smile. When a dog opens its mouth and gazes up at you with this goofy expression, it seems like it's smiling. But is it? Today's final mystery is about that silly-looking doggy grin. Are we just anthropomorphizing when we look at a dog's face and say that it's smiling at us?
Or do dogs make that face on purpose as a way of communicating emotion to a person?
Well, dogs do make eye contact with humans very frequently, and few other animals do this. So researchers actually tested dogs and wolves with food inside a container that was hard to open. So when wolves failed to open it, they just, you know, they gave up and they walked away. But when dogs failed to open it, they looked around for a person, and then they gazed intently at the person as if they were trying to get them to step in and help.
There's also a chemical process going on because when humans and dogs stare into each other's eyes, both apparently experience a rise in levels of oxytocin. And oxytocin is a hormone known to play a role in social bonding.
And in fact, with dogs that were given oxytocin to sniff, they then spent more time staring at people. So yeah, clearly there's something going on here on a chemical level.
So eye contact is important. What about facial expressions?
Well, obviously, you know, as humans, we appreciate the way that all of the different parts of our face come together to create these complex expressions. And for dogs, the same is true in the way that we interpret their expressions. We look at not just their mouths, but their eyebrows too. There's something when the inner part of the eyebrow raises that gives them that puppy dog eye expression. That is something that's just so. It's just, you know, it's
irresistible.
It's irresistible, right? It's like when a dog, even whether you're a dog person or not, when a dog looks up at you with those puppy dog eyes, it's like you just want to give them everything. So at a shelter, scientists used a facial action coding system to measure expressiveness in dogs' faces and then tracked when the dogs were adopted. And they found that dogs that did that puppy eye expression were adopted more quickly.
Oh, that's amazing. So they make these facial expressions and they get rewarded for it. But is that behavior intentional?
Well, that's a good question. There have been more experiments looking into this. So in another set of experiments, dogs were presented to people. Some of the people were food givers. So they gave the dogs the food. Some did not. And there was no difference in the way that the dogs made faces at these people, so they didn't make puppy dog eyes at the food givers more. And scientists thought that if they were doing this intentionally, if this was a means to an end, if they were like, okay, I know that if I make this, you know, really sad looking face, someone's going to give me food, then you could expect to see that the people that were tasked with, you know, they were the ones that handed the dogs food, that the dogs would make those faces at them more, but they didn't. So from that, it seems like they just do it, but they don't necessarily do it with intent.
So back to our mystery. What about the smile, the doggy grin?
The doggy grin, yeah. So researchers say you have to be cautious about equating it too much with a human smile. So dog owners who know their individual dogs well can read dog behaviors and label them, but scientists are a little more wary about that. So they need more data. And because people do have a tendency to anthropomorphize just in general, and because analytic tools can be subjective, what we call a dog smile could just be our own interpretation of it. So there's been lots of research into dog behavior, but dog expressions in general are understudied. And so at this point, a lot more research would be required to pinpoint the meaning of different facial expressions in dogs. And ultimately, as charming as a dog's face may be, research simply doesn't support that they are literally smiling.
But does that matter? I mean, our bond with dogs is still special.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't matter whether they're technically smiling or whether we just think they're smiling. You know, they follow and they understand human gestures in a way that no other animal can. They respond to subtle variations in human voices. And given the uniqueness of this relationship, there's still plenty for both dogs and humans to smile about.
Thanks for joining us today for Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. All of today's canine mysteries, how did dogs get to be dogs, what do dogs dream about, and are dogs really smiling at us, are available as Life's Little Mysteries articles on our website, livescience.com. You can also find out more about these mysteries in the podcast notes.
Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter for even more Life's Little Mysteries and for the latest science news. You can also join the conversation in our Live Science forums, where you can pose Life's Little Mysteries questions of your own, or even suggest topics for upcoming podcast episodes. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss out on new episodes. What will we talk about next? It's a mystery.
Literally, it'll be another Life's Little Mystery.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audioboom as part of their Audioboom Originals Network.